do stuff. Okay. Yeah. Songs off the new record, and maybe one older song that I played in Belgium.
Mr. Franklin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The set will probably be an hour.
It's fine.
Okay. 50 minutes to an hour, I guess.
Do you have extra songs in stock for encore?
Yeah, it's tough because that's only, well, there is an instrumental song that I usually do with the band. But I can't really do it solo, so I stretch out.
What's the name of it, the title?
It's called Trailways.
That's one of the three videos that you were filmed in New York.
Yeah. It's like a 12-string song. I mean, I could do it solo, but I can't really travel with the 12-string.
Yeah.
So I kind of stretch out other parts that I can't really do with the band of the songs. So there's like sort of introductions and endings that I don't do with the band. The songs are much shorter.
But now that you play, when you happen to play solo songs that you've recorded on time off with a band, and some of the songs were also existing in the prior, early, you were playing some of them solo. Do you still play them the way you were playing them before recording the album,
The
whole experience with the trio changed everything?
It kind of changed. It changed it. I mean, it may be similar to the way I played them before, but they've changed since then. I've kind of have a new perspective on it, where I think playing the songs with a band and then going back to it solo, I've kind of even tried to be more expansive playing solo, because it's more difficult to do that with the band, because those other guys have to follow me and they might not necessarily know where I'm going. I might not know myself, but it's easier for one person to take the risk and not have anyone following you, you know? Because all of the stuff that's more expansive with the band has to be sort of mapped out and planned in a way where solo I can just adapt a bit more to like what's happening in the room and how I'm feeling and it's more spontaneous.
The different performances of the tracks with the band were pretty much not straightforward, but you were saying that you have less.
I don't see any levels. You want to check the level?
There was, in a way, less room for improvising with a band.
Well, it's just a different. It's different because it has to be. We all have to be aware of it and ready, and it takes a bit of time, like playing together quite a bit. And the more that we play together as a band, the easier it gets. But there are gaps where we don't play, so we kind of have to build up to it.
Mm.
We have built up to it in a way, but it's always more natural when like we're on a tour or we had been rehearsing a bunch, simply just because we can kind of read each other more, and particularly like when I start going in a certain direction, they get a sense of how to follow it, or, you know, because the rhythm section kind of is guiding everything, but if I go in another direction, they have to follow it, you know? So it can be kind of like a push and pull kind of thing, which can be interesting, you know? And it's definitely, those guys definitely know how to do that, so it's, we've been playing, particularly John, the drummer, like we've been playing together so much. Most of that music has been improvising, so that aspect of it is natural for us. So it's easy, but like I said before, like playing solo, I can pretty much do whatever I want to do and, you know, adapt to the circumstances.
Mm.
You know? Like if I'm feeling apprehensive or something's not sounding good, I can end the song, you know, or if I'm getting into some sort of meditative thing with it, I can play it for longer, you know, for better or for worse, you know.
Are you currently working on new songs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm currently working on new songs for another record, hopefully to be recorded like early next year, so it can come out sometime in next summer, you know.
And do you have any idea? Yeah, it's not the one record you were mentioning earlier, that last day you were talking about doing a record for.
Maybe.
Doing a record for important records.
Yeah, that's already recorded.
That's already recorded.
Yeah. That's with.
That's all new material too?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all new material. It's all improvised stuff. I went down to West Virginia and spent a weekend there. I played a solo show with the Black Twig Pickers. And then Mike Gangloff, who was in Pelt and the Black Twig Pickers, he rented a studio for a day and a night. And he brought a lot of the instruments that he uses in Pelt. Gongs and some Indian instruments, and he also brought, you know, basically everything. He brought violins, banjo, so we basically had a bunch of instruments, and we had sort of small ideas of what we wanted to try, and just work through a bunch of stuff. And it's all varied a bit, but it's mostly all improvised. So we were kind of tapping into some of the more kind of improvisational things that Pelt does,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that I have done in the past. And, you know, it was interesting to work with him because I'm a fan of his music, and, you know.
So it's only you and Mike?
Yeah, just me and Mike. So it was, and the studio was really amazing. The guy who ran the studio was a friend of Mike's who ended up playing upright bass on one of the songs. And he bought this like 150-year-old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, and he built a studio like within the house. And the control room is like upstairs, and the main recording room is downstairs in like a big room. And then there's kind of a balcony that you can look down. And it's just a really old, rustic house, you know, on farmland. So it was a nice setting to kind of get into the mindset to record the record, you know.
But you recorded once a bunch of tracks with the Black Twig Pickers, which sounded more like traditional or...
Yeah.
And is it something you would like to explore? Like kind of
like traditional...
Dialogue with tradition?
A little bit, but I don't necessarily want to just do traditional songs. I appreciate the music, and I certainly appreciate the musicianship and the playing and the sort of approach, particularly with the Appalachian music that those guys are kind of paying homage to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those kinds of songs, there's traditions, and most of the time the songs are never played the same once. They always have their own kind of stamp on them with whoever is playing them. And they do that. They do that with those traditions. Like, they keep them loose and keep them sort of natural, which is refreshing, because a lot of people who play those kinds of music, like bluegrass,
mm-hmm.
and you know, old traditional, old timey stuff, it's always very like technical and polished, where that was never kind of the intention of the tradition, you know.
Reminds me of this. I think it is in this text by Anderson, which is all about, you know, why I've been doing avant-garde little bit of music, where it talks about folk culture and folk music and the very fact that, you know, folk culture should be kept open alive. And I had this conversation earlier this week, last week, with this art historian working on Henry Flint, and we were talking about how Bob Dylan, when he got electric,
mm-hmm.
was a huge influence on Henry Flint, which is
really
kind of surprising. But
he was an influence on Henry Flint?
Yeah. It is, when he went electric, it's basically the reason which, the occasion which gave him the idea of playing this record with Walter DeMaria on electric guitar and drums.
Yeah.
The fact that Dylan was, you know, actualizing or was not in this conservative vision of folk music, since that he was bastardizing music
mm-hmm.
with new ideas, and was something really important to play.
Yeah.
And that just reminds me of what you were saying with what the guy's been helped to do.
Yeah, and Henry Flint certainly took those aspects and particularly concentrated on that kind of the more openness of that tradition and the more kind of like playing just not technically but feeling with not worrying about being sloppy and just being a bit more real with the music, you know? And that's what I appreciate about the Black Twig Pickers, because they play all the time, but they understand that part of the tradition, and they keep that thread through their music, you know?
Mm.
And just the fact that, you know, they have Pelt, where that thread also runs through Pelt, but it's coming from a completely more avant-garde approach. But both genres have the same kind of thread through them, and you can feel in Pelt that there's an amount of control that they can have, like, with their music,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I've always appreciated, you know, so many people kind of try to do that kind of music, and the fact that they do it like just acoustically. And their new record is really amazing, and it's all acoustic, you know.
Do you think that the Black Twig Pickers inscribe themselves more in the tradition of strictly Appalachian music, or do they also explore a repertoire which goes from, I don't know, British folk music or
Appalachian sources? Well, I think particularly I can't speak for them. I'm sure they can. They'd be able to explain it much better than me, but it seems like their intentions with that group is they continue the tradition of their area of sort of West Virginia, and there's such a deep well of tradition there,
mm-hmm.
and of sort of the Appalachian style music, and there's so many different kinds of players, and some of them which are still alive, who are legends, but that aren't maybe necessarily appreciated, but maybe in their own community. It seems like there's a whole world of players who still hold that kind of like naturalness of the original kind of Appalachian style, that are in their 90s and that are still playing, and there isn't the level of appreciation that other players that are playing festivals that are more technically advanced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's two different kind of worlds in that music, and the Black Twig Pickers are definitely more interested in the real kind of tradition and the people who aren't necessarily like they're playing it because they've been their families have been playing it for generations, and their stories, and they're not out there, they're playing because it's a part of their life.
Mm.
And they pick songs and tunes and things that aren't really known to a lot of people, so they kind of keep that appreciation for the sort of unknownness on a big scale, you know. So they're playing songs that people don't really understand or haven't heard, but have been traditions for over a hundred years, you know.
Do you think there's the same kind of new pick on country music, for instance, which from my perspective is certainly a newer, more recent kind of music than Appalachian music, of course. But do you think that there's also these days sort of a new pick on country music, which is opposed to country music, which would be sort of fossilized, or do you think that there's a new generation of people who?
You mean like popular people, like popular music,
popular
or
people, but people who just are keep faithful to stay true to maybe more spirit.
Yeah, I think so.
The letter of country music, or?
Well, the thing about country music that's inspiring, that is still sort of existing, that I think people are trying to keep alive is the fact that they're, like, for instance, in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
back in the 70s, 60s, and probably earlier than that, there's like a community of musicians, and studios existed, and I think people really got, you know, created this kind of scene where they really perfected their craft, and it wasn't necessarily for any kind of like huge popular success. I think their intentions were to kind of in an engineering perspective and a recording perspective, they kind of had their own approach and wanted to make the music sound as good as possible. So there were a lot of studios that weren't necessarily fancy or expensive, that a lot of those artists recorded at, you know. And you couldn't, it seems like you can't just like go there and be like, hey, can I record at, you know, so and so studio. You'd have to be kind of integrated into the community or the scene. And it seems like that kind of perspective is not really around anymore, but I feel like some of those studios still exist down south, you know. A lot more people are recording music at home and not having to go into a studio, or building their own kind of makeshift ways to make albums and things. But at the same time, it seems like there are people who still want to kind of do that kind of thing where they have, you know, nice kind of older equipment and are able to make a decent good recording, you know, for not that much money. And but you can, the thing is, you don't need tons of money, you just kind of need to know how to do it and have your own unique sort of approach to it. So I guess that kind of spirit of like country music look, you know, is something that people want to kind of take with them now and try to still keep that sort of approach going. It's mostly, it seems like it's just, you might, the music might not necessarily sound like country music, it's just how those people had a, you know, a network of recording studios and how they could, you know, call up their friends and be like, hey, do you want to play on my album, or do you want to play on this person's album, or can we record at your studio and have an engineer come. It was sort of, they all sort of knew each other, and I mean, for better or for worse, I'm sure there were disagreements and people didn't like each other, but it just seemed like it was a network where you can kind of get things done in an interesting way, and there's a community of people that you can, a pool of artists and musicians that did different things that you can kind of call on to play on your albums, you know. That kind of exists in New York a little bit. There's a community of musicians that, and like studios where, you know, we can kind of call each other and be like, hey, do you want to help me with this album, or do you know someone who can play drums or pedal steel or, you know, bass or keyboards or something. So I guess that kind of community stems from the ideas of like country, like the real kind of country music that was being made in the '70s and stuff.
But there's something which has been fascinating me for years. In fact, for instance, when you look back at the way Dylan, for instance, decided to record in Nashville, which really pissed off Grossman, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing in Nashville?
Yeah.
But and the way that bands around New York, for instance, former members of No Name.
Oh, Dave Shuford? Or the guy who has a studio?
Spear,
oh,
instance.
Right, yeah, Dave, that's
Dave.
Him, yeah.
Dave has a real, I guess, yeah, tremendous interest for country music.
Yeah, he does, for sure.
But is it something, this kind of circulation of ideas and influences between the East Coast and, let's say, New York scene and the South,
yeah.
Is it something which is pretty recent, or is it something which has always been going on since, like, the times, let's say, of Bob Dylan, or... who as an East Coast person decided to go and record in the South and show that country music was like a huge influence.
Well, I think that, you know, Dylan
music.
Yeah, I think there's just people who have an appreciation of the history of American folk music and folk music in general. Like, country music can't be denied out of that appreciation. And, you know, even with, like, the first sort of records that had been made in the U.S., it's all, you know, it was, like, rhythm and blues and country. And a lot of those artists were almost on similar, like, trajectories where they were making records and traveling around the country. And they were, like, dying. They weren't rich. And a lot of them died very young and were very prolific, and their stories are very interesting. So I think Dylan's interest in country music kind of stemmed from his wide appreciation of, like, folk music in general. And, you know, when it's his, I think for me, his most interesting period was when he really showed that his knowledge of that appreciation when he did all those basement tape recordings in Woodstock with the band. And you can really hear the spirit of his whole wide range of knowledge of American folk music. And there's definitely a lot of country songs on that record. And I guess for someone like people in New York, like particularly Dave, I mean, he comes from the South, but he also, I mean, those guys in No Neck blues band have such encyclopedic knowledge of music, and you know they they're just such a well of you know just hit they just know they're just appreciators in a big way. So for Dave to kind of have that appreciation and have that interest, well, for one thing, he is from the South, so it's part of his history, but you know, I think it stems farther than that, where could be compared to Dylan's interest, which is just, you know, some of that music can't be replaced, and you know, pave the way for music in this country in general. It can't get any sort of more real than it was then. You know, it kind of stemmed from there and has progressed to what it is, for better or for worse. But those were like the beginnings of it, you know.
And I know that someone like J.J. Cale is someone that whose music you are appreciating, and sort of paid on the you covered the song,
yeah,
Crying Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You did this a wink to the J.J. Cale artwork with Golden Gun.
Yeah,
but I might be less familiar with his music, which I love. But I, do you think that is also how much his music is instructed and informed by the tradition, or how much do you think his music is more like an autonomous universe of itself? Or have you been able to understand how much his music was,
where he's coming from?
Yeah, and how much his music was conveying a tradition or.
Well, he definitely has his own kind of. He really has his own unique stamp on the music. That's what really kind of drew me to it. Well, it didn't really sound like anything else. But the thing about J.J. Cale was he was originally like a session player, guitarist, and he played on many albums, and he was a really talented engineer in the studio before he kind of recorded albums. So I think he kind of had tons of experience, and in a way I feel like his albums, they're so kind of like laid back that I think he didn't put much pressure on himself to make these sort of grandiose recordings. So, and he already had all of the wealth of studio knowledge, and he's played in all different kinds of recording scenarios. I think he wanted to do something super simple. I mean, this is my own sort of take on it. It could be different, but just when I listen to the music, it sounds very effortless. Even with the way he sings and the playing, it has this kind of like real airiness to it. And it has this real easy kind of feeling. And I think you can kind of hear certain, maybe elements of country and rhythm and blues, but you know, like I said, he has his own kind of take on it. And the fact that he was using, you know, drum machines, I mean, that seems like he was sort of a pioneer of that idea, and using them really effectively in the studio makes me think like he just wanted to experiment with certain things. And there seems to be this whole mystique about him, like he has this kind of withdrawnness to him, and he's like a recluse. And you know, there's stories of him just recording parts of that record like in his mobile home in the desert, and maybe he didn't have a drummer, therefore he decided to use a drum machine. So he has this really kind of cool mystique about him, you know. I don't know, his music is just pretty unique. So to kind of figure out where he's coming from and draw comparisons, it's not that apparent, you know.
And as a singer, did he have any kind of influence on your own singing?
I don't know.
Seven Dirty Kill is not a powerful singer.
Yeah, he's not.
It's Game of Thrones, and
yeah.
He has this attitude, which in a way reminds me of yours.
Loosely. I think it has been an influence. But it's like I've maybe been trying to progress away from it, because it's, for me, I just felt like I'm still working on the way that I sing, and I'm getting more comfortable with it. And JJ Cale's vocals are a bit understated, but that's his choice. And maybe I was influenced by that, but also just working on my own singing style, and the fact that I was singing kind of quietly wasn't necessarily a homage to him, but just the fact that I was working through and getting a bit more comfortable with singing.
What other singers do you have in mind?
Well, I really like the naturalness of the way that Bert Jansch sings.
Uh-huh.
I don't necessarily want to copy his style, but he has this real unique singing voice. And Fred Neil is another singer that I really, really like. And Sandy Denny is another singer who just is so, her voice is just so beautiful. And the singer from Dando Shaft, I can't remember her name, but she's another one that I really like. And I also like, you know, Christy McVie's voice, like just the fact that it kind of has this forlorn sort of soulfulness to it, but it's not grandiose in any way. It's not like she's singing in a gospel style. It just has a more natural kind of range or something, you know? I think I just appreciate people who, I mean, there are levels of singing, but people who just sing naturally. It's not affected, and can find their own sort of voice. And I'm still trying to find that, but you can hear that with certain singers, you know, where they're not pushing things. It's just they found a kind of natural way, and you know, a sort of what their voice can do, as rather than forcing it to do something else, you know. And much like Dylan's voice, I love too, and his singing. A lot of people, you know, complain that he can't sing, but I think he's like an amazing, you know, if you listen to sort of his material, like particularly like later, like in the 70s and stuff, it's all about his delivery. It's just no one can really match it, you know. And it's definitely soulful, so.
But how do you understand, for instance, the fact that during his country records, he had this completely different voice?
Yeah, I don't know. I was always baffled by that. That's not my favorite of his styles. I think it's very odd. I don't know what he, you know, was thinking. So Nashville Skyline is probably like my least favorite record because of that.
Because of voice?
Yeah. I mean, I like some of the songs, but just, I don't know. I wasn't sure, like, it's a bit mysterious why he did that. I mean, it's still interesting because he was always just evolving and trying different things, you know. But I'm not really sure why he went in that direction. It's pretty odd.
Have you already seen him playing live, even hell, before he passed away?
I've never seen him, unfortunately. Yeah, I wish. I really wanted to go to one of those concerts that he hosts, that he hosted,
yeah.
You know.
Same goes with Robbie Robertson.
No. I mean, Robbie, it's a shame because Robbie Robertson is like one of my favorite guitar players, but it seems like he really kind of screwed over the other members of the band, and those guys, like, either died broke or arm broke, you know, or never got what they deserved from the music. And I don't know the specifics, but it sounds like a lot. Most, you know, all of those guys were, didn't like him. Sounds like he screwed a lot of the people over. But I love his guitar playing, particularly like with Dylan, and you know, of course, the band.
Mm. Have you read this Wheels in Fire by Stephen Hill?
No, I've never read that book.
It's an interesting book, with tons of anecdotes, especially about the Last Waltz concert,
mm-hmm.
and the backstage scenes, which were not filmed by Scorsese.
Right.
Which, according to Ian Helm, were the most interesting things to record.
Why? Because of all the people that were there? And
yeah, the Jean Cocteau room, as they call it, which was this made-up white room with hundreds of nostrils that they had cut out from the masks, hanging on the walls, with a glass table in the middle of the room, with razor blades and cocaine everywhere.
Yeah.
That's where everything was happening, but nothing was planned about.
I wish, yeah.
The Cocteau room after the show. But they were saying, even Ian was explaining that Robertson was never singing, but he also always had a mic, but the mic was not plugged in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For that particular concert? Or
no,
for
in general.
In general,
he was
yeah.
the only one not singing, really. In the band.
Yeah.
But apparently they did a mistake during the last walk, and his mic was on.
He seems so coked out, like, of his mind in that film. He keeps doing that, like, intense sniff. Like, Robbie Robertson seems... they all seemed out of it, but he particularly just seems so coked.
I think that during the editing of the film, Scorsese was editing the film at Robertson's house in L.A., and throughout the editing, they've shown footage to Neil Young's manager, I think, and they realized that there was so much footage of Young with his nostrils completely white with cocaine. That
yeah.
That used sort of like special effects to delete.
I heard about that. Well, I think the first time I saw that film, I watched it on a VHS tape because I worked at a video store.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like someone telling me about it. I think it was before they maybe went in and re-edited it for the DVD.
Yeah.
But it was an old VHS copy, and you could totally see it. You know, it's really funny. The thing that I am interested in with The Last Waltz is the fact that, like, Bobby Charles was there and he
yeah.
played, but there's no trace of it, of the footage or recording of it. But I would love to have heard that, you know. It's a shame that he didn't get kind of any recognition within that film or in general, you know.
It was a huge negotiation between Robbie Robertson and the rest of the band as to who would be invited or not, who would be filmed or not.
Uh-huh.
They disagreed a lot on that.
Oh, really?
I did not understand the reason why Robertson had invited, without telling the other members, that one musician, because they had absolutely nothing to do. That one musician had absolutely nothing to do with the history of the band. And
who?
And I can't remember. It was obviously not Van Morrison, but there was another...
Dr. John or someone?
No, it was another one.
Was he in the film?
He was in the film, and they were like, why?
Was it like Neil Diamond?
Yeah, Neil Diamond.
Yeah, I was always curious
they
why.
They were really pissed off with that choice.
Yeah,
and
who was that? Was that Robbie Robertson's
yeah,
choice?
It was Robertson's. It was politics.
Yeah, because he doesn't fit in with that.
Yeah.
I never thought... I think... Yeah, I didn't know why he was in that movie. Strange.
And on the contrary, as far as I remember, the fact that the seven singers, for instance, were there was... All the... Basically, the black musicians were even the Hell's choice.
Yeah, sure.
Really
I can...
Important for him to have
of course.
Soul and blues
yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
But then during the editing, yeah, they were like, where are the images of our session with these black people?
Yeah. They're like, not even there. I want to read that. Yeah, I will.